This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Fascist is a dirty word in politics. And before he even took his seat in the Oval Office, critics of President Trump branded him with it, the same term that's been used to describe notorious autocrats like Hitler and Mussolini. The past few months have added fuel to that particular fire. On June 1st, the president told governors on a private call that they needed to clamp down on protesters and throw them in jail.
And the winds dominate. If you don't dominate your city and your state, they're going to walk away with you. And we're doing it in Washington and D.C. We're going to do something that people haven't seen before. But you're going to have total domination.
Later that day, federal troops cleared protesters in D.C.'s Lafayette Square with chemical irritants and batons to make a path for President Trump. The next day, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich tweeted, quote, "I have held off using the F word for 3.5 years, but there is no longer any honest alternative. Trump is a fascist and he is promoting fascism in America." So let's get into it. What is fascism? Is Trump a fascist? And what does calling him that mean for America? Many of you shared your opinions on the question with us, and we'll hear those throughout the hour. But first, with us from New York is Ruth Ben-Ghiot. She's a professor of history at New York University and the author of the forthcoming book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Hi, Ruth. Welcome to 1A.
Hi, nice to be here.
Also with us from New York is Masha Gessen. They're the staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Surviving Autocracy. Masha, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And joining us from New Haven, Connecticut is Samuel Moyne, professor of jurisprudence and history at Yale University. His book is called Not Enough, Human Rights in an Unequal World. Hi, Sam. It's good to have you.
Nice to be with you.
Okay, so very quickly, I'd like to hear from each of you in just a few words to start. Is President Trump a fascist? Yes or no? Sam?
Not yet. I think he has some fascist tendencies, but the state is not fascist, and it's distracting to say so.
Masha?
I would say that he is performing fascism. He has been putting on a show, especially in the last few weeks, that communicates that clearly.
And Ruth, your thoughts?
I think that Trump connects to fascist lineage and is using many of the elements in the playbook. I think that using the word fascism for him is a little bit restrictive. He's an authoritarian.
All right. Well, we heard from lots of you with your thinking on whether or not President Trump is a fascist. We heard from Marlena in Washington State. This is what she left in her inbox.
It's clear that what Trump is doing now is manifesting what he has been saying and being since 2016, a fascist dictator. He wants nothing more than power. He doesn't care how many lives he forsakes in the process. The man cares nothing but for increasing his own power. We are seeing fascism before our very eyes, and if our government does nothing about it, I can't stay in this country any longer.
Marlena, thanks for your message. Ruth, I think it's important for us to define fascism. What are the trademarks of a fascist regime?
So fascism as a historical phenomenon was, you know, in the interwar period, the 20s and 30s, early 40s, it is historically a one-party state, a dictatorship, a system of organized violence where you have one leader with total power who has shut down, you know, free judiciary, free press, no opposition permitted, and directs repression. All the resources of the state go to his, you know, ideological agendas, including repression of so-called enemies of the state. They could be, you know, the left, racial, ethnic, religious minorities, non-heterosexuals, in the name of saving the nation and expanding prestige. But the dictatorship, the one-party state, is crucial to historic fascism.
Well, one of you texted us, the Trump administration is not a fascist regime. Fascism is characterized by a centralized economy and a very tightly regulated society. Examples include Spain under Franco, Germany under Hitler, and Italy under Mussolini. One-party politics is another hallmark of fascism. Trump is an authoritarian. He uses power and the police to squash opposition and maintain order. Poland is an example of authoritarianism as well. Sam, as we're talking through this, we hear a lot of terms thrown around. totalitarianism, authoritarianism, populism, nationalism. How is fascism distinct from those other ideas?
Well, I think it's an intensified version of some of the above, and when it reaches the point of becoming a fascist regime, it becomes authoritarian and dictatorial. Maybe not all authoritarianisms and dictatorships are fascist, but the fascist dictatorship in particular played on the fact of prior national catastrophe, and it made a cult of violence central to the way it ruled, including pursuing enemies. So the question is, I think the very specific question ought to be, what terms do we choose to help us understand our situation? Which ones distract us? And more important, which terms help us recruit more allies and friends? This is a conversation among friends, but we are hoping we get even more because there's an election coming, which could, and I believe will, throw Donald Trump out of power. And the question is, how do we prepare for that? And how do we reckon with the aftermath of this phenomenon? Does calling it fascist now or later help us get clear?
So to your mind, what is the right term or the right terms to employ?
Donald Trump is the weakest president we've had in a number of decades, and the power he's deployed has been power that we gave the American presidency. Before we began looking abroad to Eastern Europe or to the past of Italian fascism or Nazi Germany, we gave the presidency a lot of power, and he's using it. And yet, even when he does use it, he's been checked in powerful ways that really have no parallel in autocracy or fascism. Consider the Lafayette Square example. It's horrendous, like Portland, but you had a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, apologize for being part of it, something none of Hitler's generals ever would have done.
But the fact that it happened, I think, is what is even more concerning to people. The fact that there was enough space for that to actually occur.
Absolutely. But remember, D.C. is under federal jurisdiction. That's part of the power we've given the federal government and the president in particular to rule a part of the country. There have been military troops used in urban settings in the past 50 years many times under both parties, presidents, notably in 1968. So I think we need to use this as an opportunity to reflect on what tendencies in American history created Trump, including our own prior choices.
Still to come, what do people who have already watched their country shift towards a singular dominant ruler have to say about what's happening in America? We'll get their takes plus more from our guests, New Yorker writer Masha Gessen, NYU history professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat, and Yale Law and History professor Sam Moyne. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, a truly affordable online counseling service. Fill out a questionnaire online and get matched with a licensed counselor best suited to your mental health needs. Whether it's depression, anxiety, or trauma, BetterHelp will help you overcome what stands in the way of your happiness. Learn more at BetterHelp.com and get 10% off your first month with promo code 1A. BetterHelp. Get help anytime, anywhere.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Every business has to figure out what to charge for its product and how to keep out competitors. You know who does this better than anyone else? Drug dealers. On the next episode of Planet Money Summer School, we explain pricing theory with a drug kingpin. Summer School. New classes every Wednesday. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
I'm Jen White. We're talking about that F word, fascism. It's a term that's not new, but it's being used a lot at the moment. President Trump is doubling down on a law and order message, but is it really fair to compare him to fascist leaders, including Adolf Hitler?
I'm from Germany. I was 10 years old when World War II was over. So my family and I, we lived under the Hitler regime. And when I see this man in the White House, he is going that way. You know, the people in this country should wake up. Little by little, he is getting there. But be aware.
Thank you for that message. Our guests today are New Yorker writer Masha Gessen, NYU history professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat, and Yale Law and History professor Samuel Moyne. Ruth, give us a history lesson. What are some of the pivotal moments throughout history that have defined fascism, and how do they compare to what's happening in America right now?
Fascist regimes, classically they came after World War I, after a period of enormous disruption in which, you know, four empires fell. But times throughout history when right-wing leaders, authoritarians, or classic fascists have found a following is when there's been a lot of progress in worker rights, in social, you know, progress of gender, racial emancipation. After World War I, you had the very beginnings of anti-colonial activity. You had women who had made huge strides. So Mussolini defined fascism as a revolution of reaction, which is, he was a journalist, one of his slogans, that it was an upheaval of society through violence to turn the clock back in certain ways. And this also happened in Spain before Franco came in. And so you see that when there's been periods of great progress, these kind of charismatic men sometimes come up and organize movements around themselves as they're kind of a red flag against this kind of continued progress. So that's one continuity in history when, and it happened before the coup in Chile with Pinochet. So that authoritarians can get to power in different ways depending on the historical era, but this desire to turn back social emancipation of various sorts is recurrent.
Well, a member of our text club had this to say: I think Trump would like nothing better than to be a dictator. That's why he admires the heads of North Korea and Russia. And one of you texted us, sending military troops to attack your own people is fascist. We are seeing power plays. The government wants to know what it can get away with. People are being thrown into unmarked vans and not read rights. Protesters are being attacked. I'm not sure that this is full-blown fascism, but it certainly isn't democracy. The system is failing. You know, Sam, we are seeing widespread protests across the country, but we're also in the middle of a pandemic. Is there anything in President Trump's handling of the pandemic that speaks to your argument that he's not, or we're not in a fascist regime?
I'd say so. I mean, that wouldn't be at the top of the list because, you know, just looking comparatively at the kinds of feints he's made, the law and order strategy he's trying out, and historical fascism, I think quite enough to convince us that we're nowhere near a fascist regime. But you're right that the pandemic, in a sense, provided the perfect opportunity for the assertion of autocratic power. And we can think about why he chose not to act in that way. But the amazing thing is not just the weak fascist, as I said earlier, but the fascist that defers when presented with an extraordinary opportunity, with which others took, notably Viktor Orban, the Hungarian strongman.
Masha, we've heard people talk about President Trump's use of force during protests. Are there other incidents during Trump's presidency so far that you would describe as fascist?
Well, fascism, I mean, part of the reason that we're speaking here is that fascism, the way that we use it in kind of everyday language, is a little bit of a squishy term, right? It basically denotes somebody who, or a regime that resembles a dictatorship, that gives a strong role to the military and that suppresses dissent. So Donald Trump has mostly, in those respects, flailed. He has demonstrated that he wants to suppress dissent. He has declared that the media are the enemy of the people. He has tested his ability to rule by decree and to ignore laws. And probably the thing that I find most disturbing is his ability to just violate legal restrictions placed on the presidency, violate ethics rules, ignore, for example, the subpoenas issued from the to the White House by the congressional impeachment proceedings, right? Congress, on paper, had the power to compel White House staff and former White House staff to testify at the impeachment hearing. And on paper, the White House did not have the power to ignore the subpoenas. And yet it succeeded in doing that. And we have seen a number of incidents like that through the presidency, when the White House is able to just ignore legal requirements and legal restrictions and get away with it.
We've heard a lot about what autocracy is, but what is it like to watch your country slide into an autocratic regime? Joining us now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Roya Halkakian, author of Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood in Revolutionary Iran. She was a preteen in 1979 when the Iranian Revolution transformed her home country. Roya, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much.
How did your life change when the Iranian Revolution happened?
It just wasn't what it had been in every sense of the word. One of the things that I recollect in the memoir and talk to people about, especially nowadays that statues are falling and names are being changed, suddenly within about a month or so, we woke up in a country that was unrecognizable. You couldn't recognize women on the streets because they had been driven under the mandatory veil. You couldn't recognize what street you were on because the names had been changed. You couldn't recognize the look of the squares because all the, you know, all the objects that had been there once had been pulled down and were either in the process of being replaced or had already been replaced. So it's very easy to feel entirely disconnected from the past. And as it now turns out, in retrospect, to remain disconnected even to the future.
So you were living under a very restrictive regime, an autocratic theocracy, to be precise. How do you view Trump's presidency?
Well, I think what everybody is perhaps missing in this conversation is the fact that Donald Trump has got all the theatrics right. What he hasn't got right is a political agenda and the pursuit of a clear ideology. Yes, you know, he comes and he stands in Lafayette Square Park and he holds a Bible, and that's reminiscent of other autocrats and fascists in the past. However, other than a lot of undermining of laws here and there and basically renting out golf and golf courses and hotels, there hasn't been really a very solid, clear political agenda that he has come to pursue. One day he feels that the leader of North Korea is a corrupt man who is number one enemy. Another day he respects him. So this, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini, who came to Iran in 1979, didn't feel that way about any of the issues that he implemented or he felt very strongly about. You know, the Iranian Revolution took place in middle of February of 1979. By the end of February, while Iran was in a complete state of turmoil, the very first thing that he chose to do domestically was to reinstate the mandatory dress code for women. You would think that after 2 weeks of a revolution, when so much is in chaos, when you are worried about outside enemies, inside enemies, a military coup, and all sorts of other things, that the reinstituting women's veil should be the last thing on the mind of the leader. But it wasn't. It was the first thing. So you see, I think the big difference here is that there is a lack of a clear and solid pursuit of a political agenda that is missing from Donald Trump. And while he does a lot of things that undermine the democratic processes, at the end of the day, there seems to be a lot of political corruption and not much more than that.
That's Roya Halkakian. She's the author of Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood in Revolutionary Iran. Roya, thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
We got this email from Clem who says, bottom line, Trump is a really, really dumb authoritarian. He does not have a grand plan to convert our government into a fascist state. He is simply acting out what he has always been, a fraud. He knows that winning the election is the only way he can keep his scam going, and he is getting more desperate by the day to win. We're talking about whether President Trump's leadership veers into fascism with New Yorker writer Masha Gessen, NYU history professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat, and Yale Law and History professor Samuel Moyne. And with you, I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in just a moment.
We're only months away from Election Day, and every week or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
Some historians are using the F word to describe President Trump, fascist. But does labeling him that way help or hurt his opponents? My guests are New Yorker writer Masha Gessen, NYU history professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat, and Yale Law and History professor Samuel Moyne. Well, a listener tweeted, fascism is not binary. What matters is that we can see a collection of fascist practices being rolled out by Trump. Are we waiting for an ill-defined threshold before calling out fascist practices? And Ruth, I'm going to come to you for this because one of the conversations I hear a lot right now are people concerned about a slow creep of fascism and that by the time it's recognized as being such, it's already too late to respond to it. And I think that's reflected in the listener tweet there. Your thoughts?
Well, one of the reasons I did not label Trump a fascist, although in 2016 I wrote an article for The Atlantic saying that Trump was behaving in similar ways to Mussolini in his rise to power, is that it touches on this question that Sam raised about having allies. I felt that when we think about fascism, and Hitler is always more predominant in our minds, probably wrongly, we think of some kind of instant change, a Reichstag fire and a crackdown and no opposition. And I felt it was unproductive that people would say, well, look, we're having this discussion today. There is an opposition. There are protesters. So what are you getting so excited about? There is no fascism. So I felt it was not productive to talk about fascism unless we understood fascism better in that example of Mussolini, who ruled for 3 years as a head of a coalition government in a democracy, is actually a better, for the beginning, is a better comparison. But, you know, Trump actually, unfortunately for us, he has the same temperament, when we're talking about personality, as all of the authoritarian leaders I've studied in the past. The outcomes are greatly different. And the way they get to power is very different. When we think about timing and time, you have, you know, coups where Roya was saying, you know, things changed overnight. And you have a coup where you leave the house in the morning in a democracy and you come home or you never come home because you've been killed and everything is instantly different. So it's very important. This is why I'm stressing about understanding how things work today, where liberty is taken from us little by little. Sometimes with no, quote, overt signs of fascist violence, like in Orban. Or you have the more common thing today is mass detention. You warehouse enemies far from the public eye, like Erdogan is doing. And you minimize public violence on your own citizens. So Trump is actually taking from a fascist lineage. Then he's also going on to the military coup. You had Pinochet, where the military, you know, converts to using force on its own citizens. But it's a very broad web of traditions of autocratic corruption and repression and propaganda that are summed up in what's happening today. And the people around Trump are part of that larger web. Many people don't know that Roger Stone and Paul Manafort worked for Mobutu and for Marcos, before Manafort worked for Putin. So it's not just Trump, it's the people around him. And then there's Bannon, who is the apologist of fascism, you know, and right-wing populism. So we have to keep this larger fabric in play when we think of the damage that is slowly being done to American democracy.
Well, to that thought, BC tweeted, "I think Trump is a threat, but my bigger fear is that a future politician with more discipline and vision will use the same playbook. I see Trump as a child playing with fire. I fear what a more methodical arsonist could accomplish." Sam, how do you respond to BC's concerns?
I think he's absolutely right. As was the prior, tweet about how we can't afford complacency or to trivialize even what Trump's doing, but we also should absolutely recognize that people are watching Trump and understanding how he's failed, how he's been checked, including by courts and by his own staff, and by anti-fascist mobilization. And nothing rules out that fascism returns or some new labeled authoritarianism arises in the United States. The question is, where are we now? How do we short-circuit that syndrome? And where did Trump come from to begin with? Well, it was decades of mainstream policy that caused Trump, this charlatan, to become credible to so many millions. And my suggestion is not that we trivialize what he's doing, but that we figure out how to keep a real fascist or a real authoritarian syndrome from taking hold in this country.
Well, I want to listen to some of a conversation from last weekend between Fox News host Chris Wallace and President Trump.
I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do.
Are you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election?
I have to say, look, Hillary Clinton asked me the same thing.
No, I asked you the same thing in the debate.
And you know what? She's the one that never accepted
it. I agree.
She never accepted her loss, and she looks like a fool.
Can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see. Look, I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no, and I didn't last time either.
Ruth, what did you make of that exchange?
Trump has been doing everything for years to discredit the fundamental, democratic institution of voting. And so this is just in line with throwing everything into doubt and setting up an opportunity to, not leave office. Because the thing is, once authoritarians get into power, it's extremely hard to get rid of them. Putin's just amended the Constitution so he stays until 2036, and Orban rules by decree. And I'm not saying that it's the same outcome as those countries. Our country is very different. But Trump also, they're extremely corrupt, these leaders. And they really, in a sense, it's more like Berlusconi, who tried his hardest to have laws passed that made him immune from prosecution. Trump doesn't want to leave office because he's turned the presidency into a for-profit enterprise. It's important to remember that until the pandemic hit, he spent fully one-third of his days in office visiting Trump Organization properties. So he has a very good thing going, and he's not about to leave. And I also listened to when Michael Cohen, is his lawyer who knows all his secrets, who's in prison now, said he's not going to leave office. I believe that.
Part of what I'm also hearing is a deep concern among people about the institutions that are supposed to be checks and balances, primarily voting, and whether or not those systems are really working when we look at how voter suppression has emerged across the country. And Sam, as you're talking and you're talking about the way President Trump's power has been checked, I also think there's a deep mistrust in governmental institutions to operate the way they are supposed to. So how does that fit into this conversation?
I think that's right. I think going back decades, there's a clear loss of faith in government, and it has created an opening in this atmosphere of mistrust and division for someone like Trump to actually win a shocking event. Clearly, coming in November, it's going to depend a lot on how big the margin of victory is, I hope, for Joe Biden. Trump said everything in his opposite. Hitler didn't do that. He said he would kill the Jews, and then he did it. Trump has said he would accept defeat and said that he's not sure what the situation is going to be like in November. So I think it's right that, you know, this is a wake-up call for the way we've run elections, for the way we've run policing, for the way we've run the country. And if we don't take it, if we brand our fellow citizens fascists prematurely, I think we'll be on the hook for missing an opportunity.
Masha, your thoughts as we approach the November election and in a pandemic, people concerned about mail-in voting and access to polls. What's top of mind for you?
I think Trump has made it very clear that he is not planning to accept the results of the election unless he is forced to. Right. And by forced to, I mean unless the results are so unambiguous, so overwhelming, that he doesn't have a believable way, or, I mean, it's hard to use words like believable or credible when talking about Trump, so I'm stumbling, but a way that will let him get away with throwing doubt on the results of the election. So we really have to be paying attention right now to getting the vote out, to confronting voter suppression, and to making sure that he loses by a landslide, both in the popular vote and in the Electoral College. And then goes to a larger point of the way that we talk and think about institutions in this country. Americans have this almost religious faith in institutions, as though they functioned in a vacuum, as though it weren't up to our society to make sure that they do work. And to make sure that they are suited to the present moment, and that we don't, you know, just think that we once upon a time, more than 200 years ago, created a perfect set of institutions that are going to serve us in perpetuity, which is just not going to happen.
I want to quickly get to this email from Dottie, who says, I think one thing that should be mentioned is that both parties are trying to move the country to single party rule. They do everything in their power to gerrymander districts so that the other party doesn't ever have a chance to have their vote count. And this action of never compromise is also leading towards single party rule. Ruth, we've got about 30 seconds here. Is there something larger that we need to be concerned about, as Dottie puts in her email?
I think that as my fellow panelists have said, we need to step back and look at the values that we have cherished, the way that we conceptualize power, our fetish of male power, our fetish of celebrity and success, and get rich quick, and getting away with it, because this Trump is only being who he's always been, and he's been rewarded and never chained in by institutions. Banks kept lending to him. So we have to think about what it was in our society at large that allowed him to become who he is today and be rewarded for it by becoming president.
That's Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history at New York University, Masha Gessen, a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Surviving Autocracy, and Sam Moyne. He's a professor of jurisprudence and history at Yale University. Thanks to you all. Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Find details at Ask1ATAB at the1A.org. This conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1A.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening. Now let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.